Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, May 21st, 2024. I'm your reader, Kim Dennis. Here is our first story. On the front page, let's begin with the title of GOP Candidates Pitching Voters. Forum shines a spotlight on auditor-supervisor contests by Scott Stewart. Republican candidates for county supervisors and auditor introduced themselves to primary voters Saturday morning in a small gathering in Oakland. The candidate forum, organized by the Pottawatomie County Republican Party Central Committee, comes as early voting in the June 4th primary got underway last week. Only a handful of positions are contested in the Republican primary, with no local races contested by more than one Democrat or Libertarian, and many not at all. Saturday's forum at Impact Hill included the countywide races. Two Republicans are still squaring off to challenge Democratic Representative Josh Turek of Council Bluffs in November, and U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra faces a challenge from Kevin Virgil in the 4th Congressional District primary. Incumbent supervisors Tim Wichman and Brian Shea are going up against Charlie Johnson, Adam Hauser, and Karis Crilly. Two positions on the Pottawatomie County Board of Supervisors are up for election, with the winners of the primary advancing to an expected victory in the fall. In essence, the general election is the primary election for those positions, Pottawatomie GOP Chair Starlin Perdue said. Following Supervisor Jeff Jorgensen leading the Pledge of Allegiance and an invocation by Perdue Pottawatomie County Attorney Matt Wilbur, moderated the forum, asking responses to be limited to about 1 minute each. The candidates fielded questions on how they would represent the county's rural communities, the purchase of Mount Crescent Ski Resort, and last year's special election, among other topics. All the candidates stressed their ability to engage with rural communities and take steps to ensure they are included in investments at the county level. "We've done a lot for all of Pottawatomie County," Wichman said. "That includes a lot of American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funding," Shea added. Johnson said he has attended city council meetings in several communities. "Each community is unique in its own way," Johnson said. Hauser said he's a past president of the Western Iowa Development Association. "I believe that's a misprint. Maybe that should be past president of the Western Iowa Development Association. We revamped it into more of a chamber of commerce for the county," Hauser said. Crilly said there's a disconnect between rural and urban areas. "We need to have the same collaboration and cooperation that they have in Council Bluffs," he said. The challengers pressed the incumbents to defend purchasing Mount Crescent Ski Resort and surrounding land that's contiguous with the Hitchcock Nature Center. The county bought the property for $3.5 million using COVID-19 relief funding. Johnson said the purchase lacked transparency and called the decision wrong. "When I woke up one morning and picked up the nonpareil and saw the story on the front page, I was appalled," Johnson said. Crilly said the ski resort was not a great purchase by the county officials. "It made the local news, and it was also on Fox News about how they couldn't believe a county would purchase a ski resort," Crilly said. Hauser said he's a little torn on the decision, particularly using the relief dollars. "As an outsider looking in at the time, I would have liked to have seen a lot more of that American Rescue Plan Act money go out to the smaller communities," Hauser said. Wichman said that the land included more than the ski hills and that the board didn't make the purchase until federal rules were changed that permitted the acquisition. "It expanded our recreational opportunities over the last couple of years that it's been in operation," Wichman said. "There's a $500,000 increase in revenue over expenses, so it's not costing the taxpayers any money to fund that." Shea said that $2 million in federal funds were used along with $1.5 million from the Iowa West Foundation to purchase more than 100 acres with 35 acres for the ski area. "The state really wants to see us get more parks in our area for people to get out into," Shea said. "This has been a dream of Pottawatomie County Conservation for as long as I've been involved with." On the subject of last year's special election, which asked voters if they wanted supervisors to represent districts instead of being entirely elected by and representatives of the whole county, most of the candidates joined together criticizing the effort. "Initially, it seemed to me like it made sense," Crilly said. Crilly said he advocated for making a change and said it's about representation. Hauser called the special election an enormous waste of money and resources and time and efforts. "It was ridiculous to have even brought it, in my opinion," Hauser said. Wichman said he firmly believes the county has a well-educated electorate. "They need to have the opportunity to vote for all of their representatives, not just one from their area," Wichman said. Shea said the supervisors are there to support the cities, not run them. "Each of these little towns have their city council and their mayor, and I'm going to tell you there's a lot of intelligent people out there," Shea said. Johnson said he was involved in the citizens group that opposed districts. "It would have taken representation away from the rural area of the county," Johnson said. Following the supervisor candidates and a short break, attendees heard from the two candidates for auditor. Incumbent county auditor Melvin Hauser will face a challenge from Mary Ann Hanusa, with the winner expected to be elected in November, given the absence of a Democratic opponent. Hauser and Hanusa fielded questions on voter identification, legislative mandates, and the full-time requirements of the auditor position, among other topics. On voter ID, Hauser said, "Naturally, I'm for it because it's the law." Hauser said he questioned whether voter ID was needed when it was implemented, but he has found it to be safe and secure. "It is easy and simple. Actually gets the line moving faster through the voter precinct," he said. Hanusa advocated for voter ID as a state lawmaker, noting the many places where people are asked to show ID without it being controversial. "It never made sense to me that there was all the squawking and the talk of voter suppression with voter ID," Hanusa said. "When you are doing something that our veterans have fought and died for, which is to cast your vote, that you need to show an ID and you need to prove that you are who you are to keep our elections safe and secure." Hanusa said her experience as a lawmaker would also help her advocate for changes to bills before they become requirements for county auditors. "I'm not afraid as a former legislator to be involved and make my voice heard," she said. Hauser said compliance is simple. "If it's the law, you do it. Whether that's there's property tax laws passed or election laws passed, you just do it and do the best you can," he said. The candidates were also asked to commit to serving full time. "I work full time. I'm there every day except if I've got a doctor's appointment or I have a conference," Hanusa said. Hanusa said full time means 40 hours a week, if not more, and that being physically present every day is critical. "The auditor needs to be there more often than not," she said. Perdue, the county party chair, told the Nonpareil the county party started hosting forums 2 years ago, and the party received positive feedback about offering an opportunity to hear from candidates directly. "This year's forum remained civil and positive," she said. A video of the full session will be available online at potawatomigop.com for those who couldn't attend in person. "It's really important for voters to be educated, but sometimes we're in a digital age and we just think that everything is going to pop up for us on Facebook," Perdue said. "People still want this very traditional way of having a forum where they can go and listen to the candidates." Now to the next story on the front page with the headline, "Make the Right Decision, Not the Easy Decision," by David Golblitz. The need to make right decisions now, not necessarily the easiest or least expensive, was the main takeaway from the latest of officials and community members about a proposed streetcar. "While hard, you need to make the right decision because, I like to say, 25 years from now, are you going to be happy you made that investment?" said Jeff Booth, president of Booth Transit Consulting. That's my sort of philosophy is, let's not take the path of least resistance, let's make the right choices. Booth's remarks came May 9th during the third meeting for the Council Bluffs Multimodal Connection and Expansion Planning and Environmental Linkages Study. Booth previously worked on a light rail project in Portland, Oregon, and the Washington Metro Silver Line extension. He stresses the importance of not missing out on opportunities just because it involved a difficult decision. As an example, Booth pointed to two counties in Virginia, Arlington and Fairfax. When planning their light rail system, Arlington County officials decided to route the tracks through the heart of the county, while Fairfax County officials placed their light rail system along the Interstate 66 median. Arlington County now generates 40% of its revenue from real estate development because they made the right decision, the right choice of running it right through the heart of the county, even though it was hard at the time. But in the long term, they're benefiting financially in terms of property taxes, Booth said. Meanwhile, Fairfax County didn't yield that sort of revenue because there's nothing to develop on either side of the rail line. The last time I looked, freeways are a little bit of a barrier to try to get real estate and transit projects, Booth said. So you look and say, if you had a chance to do that decision again, would you do it differently? Probably so, but they made that decision. Now they've got to live with the consequences of it. Some similar decisions faced the proposed Council Bluffs streetcar extension, which would hook up with Omaha's streetcar line that's under development. How should Council Bluffs power the streetcar? Using overhead wires, batteries, or electrified tracks? Where should the streetcar tracks begin? On the east side of the Missouri River? Should there be a new bridge across the river? And if so, how could that be affordable for the community? Booth said that depending on the grade of the bridge, a substation or other power infrastructure would be needed to get a vehicle across the bridge. To me, the bridge is probably the biggest challenge. Like, how do we cross the river and where do we cross the river? You want it to in the right place as opposed to choosing the path of least resistance, Booth said. One decision that Council Bluffs wouldn't have to make is what type of streetcar to purchase. Whatever it is would have to be compatible with the streetcar system in Omaha, so the systems would be interoperable. Omaha has already started work on its streetcar line, while Council Bluffs has not yet committed to the project as it completes feasibility studies. The Omaha Streetcar Authority is working with manufacturer CAF USA to build the city's 6 streetcars. The same company built streetcars for Kansas City, Missouri. Booth estimates that it will be another 6 to 8 years of studies and going through the federal approval process before Council Bluffs could even start construction, with an extremely tentative date for completion in 2035. Fortunately, taking the time to make the right decisions about the project, should it happen, would mean the Omaha streetcar could provide a proof of concept to residents and Council Bluffs, Booth said. The biggest challenge is people can't envision it in their community, Booth said. They just can't see it. They can't envision it. They can't believe it'll happen in their community. Omaha's streetcar should make it easier for Council Bluffs residents to imagine having the same amenity available to them. So far, the project has met with trepidation, if not opposition, but Booth predicted predictions will shift. I guarantee you the day the platform opens and people start riding it, the conversation about streetcars and Council Bluffs will turn overnight, Booth said. Now let's move inside the paper with the headline, What to Know About the Primary, by Caleb McCullough and Tom Barton. Iowa's June 4th primary election is right around the corner, and early voting is underway. Iowa has a closed primary election, which means voters must be registered with the Democratic, Republican, or Libertarian Party to participate. Voters can change their party affiliation anytime before the election or at the polling place. The primary election determines which candidates will be on the November 5th ballot in federal, legislative, and local races. How do I register to vote? The deadline to register to vote was Monday, but you can still register to vote on election day. You must bring a valid photo ID and a proof of residence if your photo ID does not contain your current address. How do I vote absentee? The absentee ballot request deadline was Monday. Mailed absentee ballots must be received by the county auditor's office by the time polls close at 8 p.m. on June 4th. Absentee ballots cannot be delivered to a polling place on election day. Voters can either deliver their ballot to the county auditor's office before the polls close on election day, surrender their absentee ballot at the polls and vote a regular ballot, or vote a provisional ballot at the polls if unable to surrender their voted absentee ballot. Can I vote early in person? You can vote early in person without mailing an absentee ballot request form. Early in-person voting is available between now and June 3rd, the Monday before the election. The early voting hours vary by county, but many offer early voting weekdays at their office. The Pottawatomie County Auditor's Office will be open Saturday, June 1st from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. for voting. You will need the same information to vote early as you do for an absentee ballot, including your residential address and driver's license or voter ID number. How do I vote on Election Day? The primary election will be held on June 4th. The polls will be open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Iowa requires voters to show a photo ID to vote on Election Day. If you do not have a valid ID, you can have another registered voter attest to your identity or provide proof of identity and residence using Election Day registration documents. Who is on the ballot? Three of Iowa's four congressional districts have primary elections this year. Republican incumbent Marionette Miller Meeks in Iowa's 1st District is challenged by Quad City Prayer Breakfast organizer David Potch. Incumbent Republican Representative Randy Feenstra, who represents the 4th District, is facing a primary challenge from Republican Kevin Virgil. Democrats Lenon Bacom and Melissa Vine are facing off to challenge Republican incumbent Representative Zach Nunn in Iowa's 3rd District. There are many other primary races across Iowa for seats in the state legislature and for local county supervisors and sheriffs. There are no statewide primary elections this year. The governor and other statewide executives aren't on the ballot until 2026, and neither of Iowa's Republican U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst is up for re-election. Moving on to page A3 with the headline, Drones Set to Return for Summerfest, by Scott Stewart. 200 drones will take flight Friday, June 7th, over Tom Hannafin River's Edge Park. The lighted drone display, put on by Fantasy Drone Shows, will be the culmination of the 4th Annual Summerfest Community Celebration. The drones will display moving images and simulate fireworks choreographed to music during the show, which will begin around 9:30 p.m. Last year's drone show was a big hit, and we're happy to bring it back this year, Council Bluffs Mayor Matt Walsh said in a press release. Drone shows are an environmentally friendly alternative to fireworks. They do not produce debris or release harmful pollutants into the air, soil, and water. Everyone enjoyed the safer, cleaner, and quieter summertime entertainment. In addition to the drones, Summerfest will take over River's Edge from 6 to 10 p.m. with a variety of family activities, including a foam party sponsored by the Council Bluffs Public Library featuring foam cannons and giant bubbles, a live art area where visitors can join Pottawatomie Arts, Culture, and Entertainment to express themselves in paint, live music from 6 to 9 p.m. on the lawn with accordion-fueled folk country and rockabilly tunes by the Prairie Gators and folk country and blues by award-winning artist Matt Cox. Recreational opportunities such as basketball, baseball, football, soccer, and yard games, courtesy of Council Bluffs Parks and Recreation and the Charles Lakin YMCA. Food options in a food truck court near River's Edge Pavilion with tacos, barbecue, hot dogs, snow cones, bubble tea and coffee, along with food and drink specialists from Terrace Hill and Full-Fledged Brewery at 4201 River's Edge Parkway near the parking garage. Additional activities include the Imagination Playground, photo ops, face painting, balloon animals, characters, street performers, and chalk art, according to the release. Attendees may bring their own lawn chairs, picnic blankets, water bottles, and snacks. Parking is available in the garage at 4250 River's Edge Parkway, in Riverside Lots, and on street in surrounding neighborhoods. Summerfest is hosted by the City of Council Bluffs with financial support from Iowa West Foundation and Back to the River in partnership with the Council Bluffs Public Library, Kiewit Luminarium, Charles E. Lakin YMCA, the 712 Initiative, and PACE. Summerfest at River's Edge is a testament to the vibrant community spirit of Council Bluffs, bringing together families and friends for a night of unforgettable fun and entertainment, Walsh said. We're grateful to our partners and sponsors for making this free event possible and look forward to seeing everyone there. Our next story's headline is New Masters Exhibit opens Friday at Hawk. Potawatomi Arts, Culture, and Entertainment is inviting the public to the opening night of New Masters, presented by Kathleen Piper on Friday evening. Pace's third annual juried exposition features more than professional photographers depicting landscape, figure, still life, urban, and abstract subjects, according to a news release. The photographers will be celebrated during a free opening night reception beginning at 6:30 p.m. with remarks at 7 p.m. A Best of Show award worth $2,500 and the Pace Gold Medal will be presented. The jury selected regional artists featured in New Masters include several different names here. We've got an entire paragraph of names, so I'm going to skip that and move to the next paragraph. Photographers from throughout the region have submitted creative images of stunning beauty, Pace board member and artist Andrew Peters said in the release. Juried into the exhibition from over 200 entries, these finalists met our gold standard of excellence. There is something in this show for everyone. Opening night will be the hottest ticket in the metro. The Hoff Family Arts and Culture Center at 1001 South 6th Street will also be holding its monthly Hoff Fourth Friday festivities. McCormick's 1894 Bar will open at 4 p.m. with a pop-up restaurant featuring Viva Fit Kitchen from 5 to 9 p.m. and live music performed by White Catfish from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. The New Masters exhibit will run through Friday, September 28th. Gallery hours are Fridays from 6 to 9 p.m. and Saturdays from noon to 4 p.m. Admission is free. Find more information on opening night at bit.ly/pace-new-masters-2024. Our next headline is Wendy's Kitchen founder follows passion with cookbook Wildflowers and Honey by Tim Roer. Council Bluffs resident Wendy Dawn Cooper has been a longtime human services professional and businesswoman. She can now add published author to her resume. Cooper recently released Wildflowers and Honey, a darling book of recipes, life stories, and spiritual moments. A book of nearly 160 pages with specific chapters on making sassy salads, savory soups, decadent desserts, bright brunch treats, sweet rolls, cakes, pastries, and other dishes. I started Wendy's Kitchen Boutique and now I'm a full-time writer, she said at an event through the Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce last week, promoting her book. Born in Harlan, Cooper moved to Florida for a time before coming back to this area. I am a longtime human service professional, counseling and addictive studies professor at Iowa Western Community College and have lived in various places through my adult life, with Council Bluffs being my home base for the most part, Cooper said. She always had a passion for baking and making things pretty, Cooper said. In 2019, while living in Pensacola, Florida, she decided to make her longtime dream of opening a quaint French-inspired bakery, boutique, and coffee shop a reality. Upon her return to Council Bluffs, she did just that by opening her kitchen boutique in the Park Building. Before I knew it, Wendy's was a sought-after culinary destination in the Midwest, she said. 2 years ago, her business changed hands, allowing Cooper to share recipes with others. The recipes that I share in this cookbook come from my creations at Wendy's Kitchen Boutique and Deja Vu Bakery and have not been written on paper until now, she said. In addition to her recipes, Cooper pays tribute to important people in her life, such as Ashley Jane, my best friend and sister love. I exclusively use Ashley's honey in all my recipes, as well as on my butter and charcuterie boards, Cooper wrote. She also recognizes Dustin Kenneth, her superhero. Together, he and I created masterpiece dishes, including many of the dishes in this book and in cookbooks to come, Cooper wrote. The Council Bluffs Chamber paid tribute last Wednesday to her new books with a ribbon-cutting ceremony. The people of Council Bluffs are my people, and I love you all, Cooper told the gathering. The book is available on Amazon, she said. It was just published on April 13th, and we're off to a good start, Cooper said. Her writing days are far from over, she said, as her next book will be a Halloween theme. Turning now to the opinions page, don't ask student borrowers to give up rights. Another view from the Des Moines Register. Young adults are bound to make a few ill-considered decisions and learn the hard way that nobody is required to look out for a grown-up's interests. But there is a difference between allowing people to experience the consequences of their action and setting them up for failure. A student loan practice that's a subject of lawsuits in Iowa is on the wrong side of that divide, and one way or another, it should stop. The lawsuits, now consolidated in federal court, allege that Iowa Student Loan, a 45-year-old nonprofit whose directors are appointed by the governor, took advantage of borrowers through something called a confession of judgment. Register reporter William Morris explored their stories in a recent investigative piece. A confession of judgment allows a creditor to take immediate action if a borrower gets behind on payments without asking for court proceedings or having to prove the delinquency. To satisfy the debt, the borrower's bank accounts can be frozen and wages garnished without even a requirement to tell the person that it's happening. The people suing Iowa Student Loan all signed the confessions as they sought to resolve difficulties in paying back their loans. Two plaintiffs had attended institutions that have faced scrutiny for shady practices, and their lawyers say they could have won challenges to the collection attempts in court. Our clients, who had no access to a lawyer, signed a document that waived every single right they had under the law, Alex Cornia of Iowa Legal Aid told Morris. They received nothing in return. Iowa Student Loan says that procuring the documents allows the nonprofit to offer better settlement terms to delinquent borrowers because of the savings from avoided litigation. Even assuming for argument's sake that money that would have gone to lawyers and court costs really does go directly into more favorable deals, it's hard to imagine settlement terms appealing enough to warrant voluntarily giving up due process and other rights. And that's the issue. Is agreeing to a confession of judgment voluntary in any practical sense of the word if it's a part of a stack of dense paperwork filled with legalese that a student lender puts in front of a 20-something experiencing financial difficulty, perhaps even financial desperation? Many states have banned or more heavily regulated confessions of judgment. Commentators say they make sense as an agreement between a pair of sophisticated business entities that are on relatively equal footing and can derive mutual benefit from excluding the judicial system from their debt repayment terms. None of that, of course, describes the student lending context. Iowa Student Loan would do better to abandon the practice, even if it can prove that it saves borrowers money, and even if it ultimately prevails in court. The Iowa legislature passed numerous new rules for Iowa Student Loan in 2008 after official investigations and reporting by the Register and others illuminated how it was misleading students and families about their options for cheaper borrowing. Then Attorney General Tom Miller wrote in a report that year that Iowa Student Loan should be held to the highest standards of conduct because of its mandate to serve public interests. Its very name conveys legitimacy and trustworthiness to Iowans. Using confessions of judgments put the lender in a bad light, regardless of any upsides. And they are not rare. The Register's Morris reported that Iowa Student Loan is filing about 10 of them a month, even in the time since the lawsuits challenging them were filed. Yes, read the fine print, but we don't need this tool. The issue is also worth the Iowa legislature's attention. The state should uphold due process principles, in particular, at least notifying borrowers before wage garnishment or other adverse actions kick in. Perhaps the statute can be recrafted more narrowly to allow confession of judgment to remain a tool for sophisticated and similarly situated entities. But if not, the legislature should err on the side of protecting consumers and barring their use outright. All of this said, it's undeniably true that we all should read and understand anything given to us before we sign it. Even in an era where ubiquitous online terms of use agreement make signing away rights without reading them seem like normal behavior. That's a reminder for young and old alike. But we can uphold that principle while still discouraging onerous provisions buried in fine print. And if anybody should aspire for better, it's the state-affiliated education lending entity. You are listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Kim Dennis. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituary. Robert Earl Nagel, October 1st, 1944 to May 19th, 2024. Robert Bob Earl Nagel, age 79, of Council Bluffs, passed away peacefully surrounded by his family on May 19th, 2024. He was a husband for more than 50 years and a proud father. He was preceded in death by his father, Wilbur Nagel, mother, Beverly Crockett Nagel, and brother, Alan Nagel. He is survived by his wife, Jennifer Nagel, daughter, Nicole Nagel Best, brother, Scott Nagel, and wife, Kathy, nephew, Christian, and cousin, Paul. After graduating from Homewood Flossmore High School in Illinois, Bob graduated from Rockford College, Illinois, renamed Rockford University, with a Bachelor in Arts, and then proceeded to Northern Illinois University, where he met his wife and graduated with an MS in psychology. He started his extensive career as a school psychologist with the Iowa Area Education Agency No. 13. Bob provided a full range of assessments, consultation, and intervention services for young people ranging from preschool through 12th grade, and was particularly fond of his work with the students at Iowa School for the Deaf. In addition to his career as a psychologist, Bob also had a lifelong passion for political science. He pursued a second career and went on to graduate from the University of Kansas with a Master of Public Administration. He worked as an assistant city manager in both Olathe, Kansas and Council Bluffs, and as city manager of Ogalla, Nebraska. While he enjoyed a lifetime in the Midwest, he and his wife made the best of their retired years, creating wonderful memories traveling throughout Europe, Asia, and New Zealand. Bob was an avid and dedicated sports fan, which began with his passion for his hometown Chicago Bears and a love for baseball. He was a White Sox fan, but also a loyal spectator of the College World Series in Omaha, Nebraska. His love for the Creighton Blue Jays began when he took his daughter to her first basketball game when she was 2 years old, and then became a season ticket holder for more than 30 years. He faithfully attended both men's and women's events across a variety of sports, including basketball, baseball, soccer, and volleyball. With a passion for the Blue Jays and an ongoing pursuit of education, it is only fitting that Bob decided to donate his body to further education at the Creighton University School of Medicine. The family would like to extend their deep appreciation to the staff, nurses, and caregivers at both St. Joseph Villa and Maple Crest in Omaha, and a special heartfelt thank you to the hospice team. In lieu of flowers, the family would appreciate support to the following organizations that Bob treasured: Rockford University, Council Bluffs School Foundation, and Lauritzen Gardens, Omaha. The family will honor Bob's life privately with a celebration of life to be announced. Marjorie Hunter Carson, February 15, 1933 to May 14, 2024. Marjorie Hunter Carson was born on February 15, 1933 and entered into rest on May 14, 2024 at 91 years old. Born in Bartlett, Iowa to Robert and Hazel Greenwood Hunter, graduating from Thurman High School in 1950. She moved to Omaha, Nebraska and worked for a Mutual of Omaha, attended Peru State College, and spent a year in New Orleans, Louisiana, before returning to Omaha and working at Union Pacific Railroad for 42 years. In 1994, she joined the Key Real Estate team, enjoying another 20-year career before finally retiring at 81 years old. She was a lifetime member of Community of Christ. She enjoyed a 63-year marriage to Jerry Carson, who preceded her in death in 2016. They had three daughters, all of Council Bluffs, and a bonus son, and several grandchildren and great-grandchildren. She is survived by her siblings, and she loved her 34 nieces and nephews, 75 great-nieces and nephews, and even great-great-nieces and nephews. Celebration of life will be held on Thursday, May 23rd, visitation 4 to 6 p.m., with a memorial service to follow at Community of Christ, 140 West Canesville Boulevard, Council Bluffs. memorials will be directed to Community of Christ. James Collins, June 24, 1937 to May 17, 2024. James Collins, age 86, passed away May 17, 2024. He was born June 24, 1937 in Omaha, Nebraska. James was a dedicated individual who served his country with honor during his time in the Navy. With a strong work ethic, James ventured into self-employment. His love for fishing served as a joy throughout his life. James found his lifelong companion in marriage when he tied the knot with his beloved wife, Betty, on August 7, 1970. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by his brothers and sister. James is survived by his wife, Betty, children Sally Baker, Donna Collins, Jimmy Collins, Wayne Collins, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and a host of other family and friends. Visitation will begin at 11 a.m. at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Thursday, May 23, 2024. Cortege will leave the funeral home at 12 p.m. and go in procession to Garner Township Cemetery for the graveside service with military honors. The family will direct memorials. Kathleen Anderson, age 77, of Honey Creek, Iowa, passed away Monday, May 13, 2024. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, May 22, 2024. Funeral service will be at 11 a.m. Thursday, May 23, 2024. Both will be conducted at Hennessy Funeral Home in Missouri Valley, Iowa. Arrangements made by Hennessy Funeral. Now let's move to some additional local news. Dow City REN alumni are given awards. John, Ernie Klein, and Mike Weber have been named the 2024 Greyhound Award recipients by the Dow City REN Alumni Association. A presentation team will recognize Klein and Weber at the upcoming DCA Alumni Banquet held on Saturday in Dow City, according to a news release. Klein and Weber have each had significant involvement in the Boyer Valley Community Schools and the districts that preceded it, Dow City, Arion, and Dunlap. In addition to paid and volunteer roles with the school, each has served their respective communities and churches in numerous roles. Klein graduated from Dow City Arion in 1979. After college, he worked 40 years as a billing clerk at Smithfield, formerly Farmland. He recorded stats for basketball and football games, and accumulating more than 40 years of service, Klein was the high school assistant softball coach for 10 years. He coached junior high track, football, and girls basketball, a role he served alongside Weber. Weber graduated from Dunlap in 1985 and spent most of his career in service to the school district. His first teaching job was at Oldebolt Arthur. In 1993, he began his tenure at Boyer Valley School District. He taught upper elementary until 2002 and then transitioned to teaching Title I reading and math for 2 years. In 2004, he became a principal for Boyer Valley and held that position until retiring in 2022 with 29 years of service. Weber also coached junior high volleyball, junior high girls basketball, and was the assistant coach for junior high girls basketball. While teaching, he also spent many summers doing janitorial work for the school. Tickets are on sale for the banquet for $30. For more information, contact Tracy Schlesinger at 712-269-2413 or dcaalumni@hotmail.com. Let's turn to sports. Silvers for Denton, bronzes for Icorn, state track and field by Peter Burtnett, Des Moines, Iowa. St. Albert's Lily Denton picked up medals number 7 and 8, both silvers, while Lewis Central's Ethan Icorn capped a decorated career ahead of his future at Iowa. Both ran in the 800 meters earlier in the day before taking on the 1500 Denton and 1600 Icorn. Denton, who was state champion in the 3000 meters on Thursday, hopes to build after improving on her medal placement last year. "It means a lot for me placing higher than what I did last year," she said. "So for me, it still feels like an improvement coming back and hopefully I can take from what I've learned here and apply it to next year. Typically, Denton aims to get out in front and stay there, but in the 1500, she made a charge to go ahead going into the final lap. "Yeah, usually I feel like I try to go out and stay out right away," she said, "but with this one, knowing that there were tougher competitors, I wanted to just try to stay with whoever was going to lead the pack and then take it at the end." Although she fell behind, Denton ran 4 minutes 46 seconds 0.23 to seal a silver medal. She also set the school record in the 800, running 2 minutes 15.27 seconds. "I knew what it was," the Saints sophomore said. "I've been, I think, consistently running between 2 minutes 19 seconds and 2 minutes 20 seconds, one 2 minutes 17 this season, so I didn't know if it was going to happen." She tried to stay behind Nashua Plainfield's Cadence Huck. "She ended up leading me to a PR, so I was pretty happy with that," Denton said. Eichorn wins 3 bronze medals to cap decorated career. Lewis Central's Ethan Eichorn put the finishing touches on a decorated career with 3 bronze medals at state. "It's kind of sad being done with high school, but it brings bigger things," said the University of Iowa commit. "Pretty solid weekend. I did some good things and bad things, but I'm pretty happy with it overall." With the pace slowing down, Eichorn made a push for the front. "Yeah, the pace was slowing down a bit," he said. "I knew my strategy wasn't good if I let so many people hang around. I still did for a while, but it closed really well for me. So I'm really happy with that, so I had to go for it." An 8-time state medalist in track and field, Eichorn knows he left it all on the track. "I left everything I had out there, so I can't be mad at myself at all," Eichorn said. "I got to snag the school record by 0.1, so it's an extra cherry on top after a hard 800 earlier. Glenwood's Bryant Keller joined Eichorn in the top 5, earning his 2nd medal of the state meet. "It means so much," he said, "my senior year finishing by medaling and just knowing that it all worked out for me and I have something to look forward to in college too." Sternberg represents AHSTW, finishes 5th in 200. AHSTW's Luke Sternberg finished off his junior track season with a 5th place finish in the 2A 200 meters. "Felt good, especially because last year I didn't make finals, didn't run my best here," Sternberg said. "So just having that experience really helped me, and all my coaches along the way have helped make the season great, efficient. Finished top 5, I have no thought of that at the start of the year." Representing AHSTW, Sternberg said he was especially proud of where he's from as the Vikings doubled their individual qualifiers from last year. "I love where I'm from. I embrace it. I wear it on my chest," he said. "And so just being able to represent in front of thousands here today, it means the absolute world, and we just had a special year. Last year, we had maybe 4 qualifiers. This year, we've got 2 medalists and got 8 or 9 qualifiers, not counting the relays too. So we just had such a fantastic year, and I know it means a lot for the community back home." Next headline, three-peat, so sweet. Riverside wins 4x4 again. Bulldogs finish tied 3rd with St. Albert in 1A by Peter Burtnett. State track and field in Des Moines. "It's not just sweet, it's a three-peat." Riverside won their 3rd straight gold in the 4x400-meter relay on Saturday at the track and field state championships. 2 were on the previous championship teams, Ellie Henderson and Lydia Erickson. After Veronica Schlesinger's opening leg, Henderson set up the Bulldogs in a close 2nd behind St. Engsgar. Then, Erickson ran an impressive 3rd leg to track down the leaders. "Well, I was pretty tired after the 4x1," Erickson said, "but coach came up to us and told me that I had to try to run a 59 at best. I saw the girls ahead of us, and I just had to mentally lock in, just told myself that I was going to go get her and finish strong." And finish strong she did. She didn't quite get the 59 seconds desired, she outran Kinsey Anderson to set up Carly Henderson. The other Henderson, cousin of Ellie, held off a straight late charge from Natalie Bork. "I think it's because I care a lot about these people on my relay and about this race, and it's not one that you can just let up and let them win," she said. "We have a purpose to be here because this is our 3rd time winning it. and I wasn't about to just let a new team take our role. And so I was going to do my best I could to hold on to what we have and keep making progress with such an amazing relay. As the starter, Schlesinger isn't sure whether opponents will put their best runner at first or anchor, so she needs to start strong. So I just know I gotta go with whoever I can, get it to Ellie, and she'll cut in and get us in an even better position, Schlesinger said. For Ellie Henderson, seeing Schlesinger go out and run her hardest puts her in the best possible position. So once she hands it to me, I know what my role is, Ellie said. And often it's hard because you don't know where somebody could be cutting in front of you or behind you. That's probably the hardest part about my role. Winning a third straight time for Erickson is sentimental. It means a lot because Ellie and I were both on the first state championship 4x4 for our school, she said. And then last year with all four of us, it just means a lot to be able to come back and do it a third time, especially Carly and my senior year. The 4x400 win is an example of the growth the Bulldogs have experienced over the last years. There's been a lot of building up getting to this point, Ellie Henderson said. I know our program wasn't much years back, but there have been a lot of girls who have set the bar and set the path for what we needed to do, and they can take credit for a lot of our success today. Weighing the expectations, the Bulldogs came in to work and do their best. I know we have a lot of expectations coming in from our families and home and just everybody at our school, Schlesinger said, but we come in and we do the best that we can. The message going into the season was that the road back after a successful year is the toughest. Coach always talks about how it's the hardest to come back after a successful year. That's your hardest year, Carly Henderson said, and they were able to do it coming back, but the relay was a completely different team making a completely different race. So I think that this year was our comeback year to make sure that we came up out on top. The Bulldogs nearly came out of top on all of the Class 1A, finishing tied for third with St. Albert on 37 points, just three behind champions St. Angsgar. I mean, it shows what the students worked hard to accomplish every single time, Riverside head coach Jared Hoffman said. So I put a ton of credit to those seniors and the juniors who were part of the last one, and they come in every single day working their butts off to do that. It took a full team effort, Hoffman added, as the Bulldogs picked up points where they didn't expect. From Sophia Fenner and shot put getting eighth place to Sprint Medley coming out on sixth place finish that got us big points, he said. And just everybody stepping up to do what they could so that we can get that trophy. For the St. Albert girls, it's a sign of improvement throughout the program. It's a big deal, head coach Teresa Martin said. The girls' program has taken a back seat for as long as I can remember to the boys' athletics. So to see these girls all year long just excel in every sport, and now we've got a big trophy to take home. Even events that didn't score impressed Martin. The 4x800 shaved 18 seconds off at district and another 17 seconds off here at state. And we were really working, she said. I think they got 12th overall, but we were just doing at the beginning of season quarter splits. But then toward the ends, we're doing 200 splits, then tightening everything up. So they were phenomenal. And then the shuttle hurdle, they worked so hard. The seniors who were new to the track and field team, Kira Hochstein, Ella Klissman, Lily Krohn, all led the Saints well. They really took the role and ran with it even being new to it, Martin said. It was pretty great. Underwood, 6th, and Trainer, 8th, both finished in the top 10 of the 2A boy standings. Our next headline, Rams Charge Through Trojans, High School Soccer by Austin Heinen. A hat trick from sophomore Brielle Allman helped Glenwood roll past Atlantic 5-0 in Friday night's Class 2A Region 3 quarterfinal in Glenwood. The Rams owned the time of possession and shots on goal, therefore controlling the tempo of this game to top Atlantic for the second time this season. Definitely nice to get some goals in tonight after having some trouble scoring in our last few games, Rams coach Amy Benson said. We did a great job of finishing the ball when we needed to, and when we barely missed, we talked about resetting and if something happens to just let it go and get it next time. The defense really played strong as well as playing the ball through the back and the middle and eventually up to the forwards. I'm very happy with how we did all through the field tonight. Though the Rams fired shots early and often at the goal, it wasn't until the 30th minute when Jalen Floyd finally put Hent Glenwood on the board 1-0, which was how the score held up to help halftime. The Ram offense didn't have to wait too long before adding to their lead in the second half, as Allman scored her first in the 46th minute, another in the 47th, and completed the hat trick in the 62nd minute. We could have communicated a bit better in the first half, but in the second half, we did better and got a lot of shots off, Allman said. We did a really good job of maintaining possession and passing the ball around, and in the second half, it led to a lot of great shots, and we sent four of them in. Gabby Lovato put the icing on the cake with a goal late in the 78th minute to cap off the Rams' scoring for the night. With the win, Rams advanced to the Region 3 semifinal, where they will head to Council Bluffs to play Class 2A No. 13 Lewis Central on Tuesday. The situation is all too familiar to the Rams, who lost to LC in the regular season last year as well, before taking revenge in the regional semifinal in 2023. The Rams hope they can repeat their offensive success on Tuesday so they can try to repeat history. We need to play quick and have quick passes to go after them, Allman said. I feel like we did a great job of connecting around them. We just let a couple of goals go and weren't able to finish some of our chances. Hopefully some of the success here can carry over into Tuesday. Last year we had the same situation and we redeemed ourselves, Benson said. We remember that feeling, and it is a great feeling. We're going to keep doing what we're doing, and hopefully we'll be able to capitalize on our opportunities on Tuesday to beat them again. The Rams and Titans will play at Titan Stadium at 7 p.m. on Tuesday. Our next headline, we're supposed to not like each other. Trainer-Underwood rivalry, a competitive bond in SHR at State, by Peter Burtnett. State Track and Field, Des Moines. Trainer and Underwood, WIC rivals, are supposed to not like each other, but competing together in the shuttle hurdle relay is great for both teams, and they stood together on the 2A podium at State. It's definitely a lot of fun running with them, especially because we're supposed to not like them, leadoff runner Brady Wallace said. However, everyone on our team, everyone on their team, we're all cool with each other. We'll come up, dap each other up, and we're all extremely close. It's a lot of fun being able to compete with guys 20 minutes down the road, added Carson Elwood, anchor for Trainer. I mean, throughout the track season, we've gotten really well close to them. We've learned a lot about them, and we're all like really good friends. So it's just fun to compete against each other, and someone had to win, and we're happy with this. Underwood's Lucas Bowes Jr. said the local competition has also helped the Eagles. I would say it's helped us so much trying to just go there to where we're at now, he said. And I think third place was not what we really wanted, but I'm very settled with it. With running a 59, we got the school record. We accomplished what we wanted to do. For Trainer, getting silver behind Iowa Falls Alden in state meet record time of 59:10 was satisfying. Definitely a lot of fun. There was a lot to take in, especially being on the line for the finals for a team that had a really good chance at winning it, Wallace said. However, things didn't go in our favor, but leading it off and being that close with Jaden DeMano, state champion in the 100-meter, 400 hurdles, was a lot of fun. Brock Casey said his nerves were calmed once he went over the first hurdle. I was really nervous before the race, but once I got over the first hurdle, it kind of went away. Really wish we could have had it, but nonetheless, he said, trailing off. With all the work put in, second place is a slight letdown, but the Cardinals are proud of the way they flew throughout the season. It's been fun running, Coy Kahn said. I mean, we were pretty good the whole year. We got here and, you know, we had a shot. We ran a really good race. We even set our new school record, but just came up short. Mason Boothley, second in long jump and 10th in the 110 hurdles, said the bronze medal felt good. It feels really good. This is a PR for us. We all ran really well, Boothby said. Great team race for us. I'm just really excited we did a good job. Bowes said the team's form was important most of all. Coach says to beat them not with your speed, but with your form, he said. Jack Von Fussen ran the anchor leg, and having seen Spirit Lake fall, the Eagles' position was established. I know we saw Stuart Lake fall, but I also saw my teammates getting to that position, Van Fossen said. I think they gave me a chance to run them down. Obviously, the last two anchors, they were really good legs, but I mean, we're close. And like Bo said, we set a school record. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil. I'm your reader, Kim Dennis. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.